Hey there, listeners. It's KJ. Our guest today is a science writer extraordinaire, and we will be talking everything from grants to the literary and storytelling aspects of that form of nonfiction. But before we do, here is something else for you nonfiction authors out there. If this is your kind of work, our sponsor, Author Accelerator, can help. And you don't even have to go all in with full-on book coaching if you're not there yet. Check out their new 4-week-long nonfiction framework program that will help you nail down your structure before you start to write, or after you're writing and realizing, this thing needs a backbone. Authors of self-help, how-to, and more academic or literary text will find the shape of their books, create a working one-page summary that reveals that shape at a glance, and develop a flexible table of contents to guide you through the drafting and revision process. You can find a lot more, including previews of much of the material, by going to authoraccelerator.com/nonfictionframework.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. I don't remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause. I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
I'm KJ Delantonia, and this is Hashtag Am Writing. Hashtag Am Writing is the podcast about writing all the things. Writing fiction, nonfiction, short fiction, long nonfiction, short nonfiction. I could probably go on like that forever. We are the podcast about writing pitches, proposals, essays, and essentially, as I say every week, this is the podcast about sitting down and getting your writing work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I am the author of The Gift of Failure, How the Best Parents Learn to Let Go So Their Children Can Succeed, and a forthcoming book about preventing substance abuse in kids. So I'm not so much writing this week as I'm deep, deep in the edits. You can find my work at The Atlantic, The New York Times, Washington Post, and at jessicaleahy.com.
I am KJ Delantonia. I am the author of the forthcoming novel, The Chicken Sisters, as well as How to Be a Happier Parent, which is out in hardback now and will be coming in paperback soon to a bookstore near you. And you can find me on Instagram at KJDA, I know my own name, and everywhere else at KJ Delantonia and KJDelantonia.com.
We have a guest today. We have a very patient guest. We've had to reschedule this guest an embarrassing number of times. And oh, I'm so excited that she's finally with us. And she's going to actually, this is really timely because we've had some questions about exactly what this writer does in the Hashtag Am Writing Facebook group. So I would love to introduce to you Miss Lydia Denworth. She is a science writer. She is a contributing editor to Scientific American. She writes the Brainwaves blog for Psychology Today. She's written 3 books, one on lead, one called Toxic Truth on Lead, a book that I really, really love called I Can Hear You Whisper. I keep it in my the literacy section of my bookcase, actually, along with some other fun books like Language at the Speed of Sight, and her new book that will be coming out at the end of January, on January 29th, called Friendship. So this is a really appropriate and wonderful and exciting book to talk about on this podcast, since, of course, I get to podcast with my best friends. So, Lydia, welcome so much to the podcast.
I am so happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, and again, thank you so much for your patience. We've had a couple of recording dates fall through, and so I'm just so glad you stuck with us through our timing snafus.
Not a problem at all.
Well, we have burning questions, not only ours, but some of our listeners. But we always love to start with the question of how you got started writing and how you landed in the genre that you landed in.
And that, in my case, is a pretty interesting story because it is absolutely the case that science was the last thing I would have predicted that I would do. I was the person who took the bare minimum of science classes all through through high school and college, and I was intimidated by it. I didn't think I was all that interested in it. I always wanted to be a writer. but I thought I would be, and I wanted to be a nonfiction writer. So I was that kid who read The New Yorker and John McPhee and things like that when I was in high school and said, this is what I want to do. But science did not come into it. And I have had a relatively long career. The first half of it was all general interest journalism, kind of. I worked for People magazine, if you can believe. In fact, with Meghan and Harry in the news this week, I don't know if I'm supposed, you know, but I was.
Do you feel the pull? Do you feel the need to go back and comment on the important social issues of our day?
I so do not, but I was at one point, I was a London bureau chief at the time that Princess Diana died for People magazine. So I have this whole past as a celebrity journalist and as these other, and I worked for Newsweek for a bunch of years. It was only when I was writing my first book, so about 15 years ago, after, let's say, a good 15 years in journalism, that I really sort of became a science writer. And at that point, I was doing I was freelancing, and I was doing those social issue features that you would find in women's magazines like Red Book and Good Housekeeping. Mm-hmm. So maybe it was sex harassment or lead poisoning. But I came to the issue of lead from a children's health perspective more than anything. I wrote a lot about education, Jess, you'll appreciate that.
Excellent.
I did things like that. And it was in writing that first book that I suddenly found that it's basically a dual biography of two of the men who were way out ahead of people understanding that lead was as harmful as it was. And then they got into this massive fight with industry over it. And they nearly, their scientific careers were almost ruined, but they fought on. They are heroes. And they got lead taken out of all kinds of things. We know now with Flint that the story's not done. But the second guy I wrote when I first got into this from I was interested in a guy named Herb Needleman, who was a psychiatrist and was looking at lead in kids' bodies. But the other guy was a geochemist at Caltech, and he was the one that understood that lead was all around the environment. And I started having to read his journal articles, and oh my God, they were impenetrable to me.
Yeah.
Right? But
it's such an education. Only just being able to get through the language, but getting at the statistics. I mean, that's a big part of understanding whether you're even looking at something worth reading or citing.
Absolutely. And so, the long story short is that in working on that book, though, I found that I actually was better at all of that than I thought. And I happen to think that to some extent my lack of background in science has worked in my favor. I am not afraid to admit complete ignorance. I do it on a regular basis with really brilliant people. And so I just keep asking questions. And, I think that everybody has to do that as a reporter, but you're especially humbled when, you're digging into something that you don't know anything
right.
about.
Well, and your second book, you started writing about hearing because of your own personal experience. And that happens to be the area of nonfiction that I love, when it's sort of your own personal investment and personal experience that then turns into this scientific exploration. So it's not just about intellectual curiosity, it's about emotional curiosity as well. And that's what really comes through in I Can Hear You Whisper, because it is also partly your story.
Absolutely. And I had done this one book of science of popular science in the lead book. But then the question is always, what are you going to do next? And here was my kid, my youngest son, Alex, is now 16, but he was just little then. And he is deaf and he uses a cochlear implant. So I kind of felt like I had this story sitting there. But then the thing that I came to realize is that because he had this cochlear implant relatively early in the world of cochlear implants, that I was essentially living a cutting edge mm-hmm. science story. And I also, in addition to the technology piece of it, I realized it was really a story about the brain, because sound getting into the brain and what comes from that, oral language and literacy. And I'm thrilled that the book is in your literacy section, by the way. That's perfect. But, you know, there was so much that I didn't know about deafness and hearing and sound and reading and how it's all related until I had a kid. I mean, my kid was the first deaf kid I ever knew was my own son, in any meaningful way. And so you're just starting over. And it was several years before I said, oh, wait, I think I really need to write about this.
Cool.
Yeah.
So your most recent book, the book that we're just really excited to talk about, this book, Friendship, is this came at a really, really good time for me in sense of one of the statistics that you quote is that the strengths of your friendships at around 50 predicts your health at 80, and I'm just about to turn 50, and I feel like I'm at a phase in my life where I have really strong friendships, and so I am feeling good about my health at 80.
Me too. I loved that line.
I really liked that.
I think we're
excellent.
I think we're all at a moment when, and it may be, you know, sort of a cohort moment, but when everybody's looking around and just going, you know, what's really matters to me is my people.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Like my people. I mean, some of those are digital people, and that's like, because some of those are real friendships, right? And but lots of them are real people, and, or, you know, real people that are like really right in front of you. And I just feel like this sort of decade or two of segueing away from being able to touch the people you love when you're with them has sort of really changed our perspective in a great way. And I think your book it really informs that.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I do feel, and I'm hearing from people that I've sort of, I think, yes, my timing might be good here because everybody's thinking about this. People have seen the headlines that loneliness is a killer, which it is, as deadly as smoking. But I also, that's always been the story, but the flip side of what does friendship actually give us and how is it protective and how does it make us resilient? And the fact that there is a biology and an evolutionary story to friendship is the piece that most people do not know. And so that is, you know, this is a book of science. It's the science of friendship, but it is so personal and relevant to people's lives. And what I hope they do is they come away understanding why friendship and relationships are as important as diet and exercise for your health. And I'm not trying to add to people's burden for what they have to do. I think instead I'm hoping to give them permission to go hang out with your friends. It's your body will thank you.
Well, I have questions about how you pitched the book, but I think, but you know, because it has that dual identity. But I think let's not start there, right, Jess?
We can. I know KJ and I have some very specific questions about the way the book Friendship came about in terms of not just the pitch, but also the funding aspect. And I wasn't sure if that's where you wanted to start, KJ. But that's what is. I'm dying to know about your funding.
Which came
right,
first, Lydia?
The Alfred P.
The idea?
Lydia has funding from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, and right. Every nonfiction writer wants to know, oh my gosh, how can I get money to do this project? Because research is expensive. I just dumped, in fact, yesterday I was just thinking about this because someone texted me yesterday saying, if I don't get a book contract soon, I'm not going to be able to write this book because I'm out of money to put into the resources. This is actually an Am Writing listener, so hopefully she's listening to this episode. And I texted back, I just dumped almost 200 books on a textbook that I must have in order to, you know, just make sure I'm really where I need to be with the research. So how on earth did you get the funding, and which came first, the contract for the book or the funding for the book?
The contract for the book came first. Okay. I had a contract with Norton, and I had an advance, but I will say it wasn't a stellar advance. My advances, so I've had three, and they are all over the place. And the middle one was by far the biggest. And so I was a little disappointed not to get more this time, but it also meant I had to get my butt in gear and get more money if I was going to do this. So fortunately, the Sloan Foundation does do these grants for science writers in particular. They are also, since a lot of this audience is female, people might be happy to know that they are looking to support female science writers, and they are looking to support projects that are about women. In my case, this book is not specifically about women, but there happen to be quite a lot of female scientists featured in the book. They're mm-hmm. kick-ass, they're wonderful, and they are all through the book. And so the combination of my being a female science writer and what I was writing about, they gave me a grant. The only thing I wish is that I had applied a little earlier. So this isn't since you all like to get into the nitty-gritty of things, you have to make up a budget, and there is a lag time from when you apply to when, should you be so fortunate as to get any money, when you start getting money. And so my budget I originally had it for an entire calendar year that I was going to be writing the book, but I discovered that it couldn't start until, let's say I originally said January to December, and then in fact, and I had like a monthly salary for myself in there. And then it turned out that they said, well, our fiscal year is June, so you can't start till June 1st. So I basically had to lop off 5 months worth of that money that I was asking for. So had I known and gotten the application in even just a few months earlier, I probably could have made it from January to December and gotten myself more money. So people should, let this be a reminder to not let this stuff linger.
Can you apply for funding before you have a book contract, or did they require you to have the book contract before you apply?
You know, I can't remember exactly. I do believe that you can do it either way, but they did mm-hmm. want a copy of my contract. If you don't have a contract, I think there are some other requirements. I'm forgetting. It's been a little while since since I did all that. And I will say that this is the reason I got it, I sort of was aware of this in the first place, was because I had met one of the people from the Sloan Foundation at a party at the World Science Festival here in New York several years earlier. And at that point, my previous book, I Can Hear You Whisper, would have been perfect because they also are very interested in technology and so the science of technology and things like that. And but I didn't know about this grant program in time. Now, in that book, I happened to have gotten a healthy advance, so that was okay. But so the second time around, I said, all right, I'm gonna write to him. They did have me hire part of the money. They added some money in order for me to be able to hire a science advisor, who actually was one of the people who's featured in the book, but I paid him.
That's so lovely.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. That's amazing.
And so that meant that he was motivated to, I mean, it's Robert Seyfarth, it says so in the book, so I can say he's one of the leading primatologists in this work. And he would have read some of the book ahead of time anyway, but he read it all multiple times and was so in my corner and so helpful and also so demanding and critical. I could see what it would be like to be their graduate students. but it was so helpful. And I wouldn't have done that if it hadn't been for the Sloan Foundation request, but it was really helpful.
Maybe we'll include the link for applying for these kind of grants in the show notes so that people can know exactly what we're talking about.
I think the Kaiser Foundation does something similar mm-hmm. too. I know they do it for shorter, I know they do it for journalism.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I do think I'll have a look and see. I at one point did find a link that had kind of a list of grants and fellowships that give you some money. I'll see if I can find it for you. But at the Sloan Foundation, it is through the public interest piece because it doesn't sort of jump out and say books right away. So just mm-hmm. FYI to people. It does have to be pretty sciencey for Sloan, but there are, as KJ just said, there are these other things like Kaiser that maybe if it's health, more health related and other things, there's more out there than I think people realize.
Absolutely. There's USC Annenberg School does it for health writing as well. There's just a bunch of great places to go. So you have the money, you have the book contract, and so you get started on the research. And I will say, bar none, the question I get most often from the nonfiction writers is, and the reason I talk about it so much, is about organization of research. And I have a multi-part question having to do with this, but how do you organize your research?
I, not as well as you, Jess. I look at what you do and I always think, when you show pictures of your shelves, I think, oh boy, that's something to aspire to. But that's, So one thing that I do is that I am still the kind of person who prints out everything. I just find it very, very hard. First of all, I would like to make sure I have the hard copy. And when I'm reading through complicated scientific work, I find it a lot easier to do it in, you know, with a pencil in my hand or a pen and kind of marking it up. And I don't know, it's still, it helps me to, maybe that's, you know, I'm showing my age. I'm just over 50. I'm 53 now as of 3 weeks ago. And so, but I, you know, I do plenty online, but I, so I have piles of files that, you know, I, for every, I mostly stored for this book, I filed everything according mostly to the individuals that were at the forefront of whatever piece of science it was I was writing about, or by subject, if that made sense, like social media. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of files about the science of social media that that were by subject. But and then I just, yeah, I think that the trick about research, because I just, oh, I can go so deep, and then you, there's always more to research, and so figuring out when to stop is
that actually leads to my next question, which is, someone specifically asked, how do you know when it's time to stop and when it's time to start the writing? Because the research can go on forever, as you stated.
Yes. So for me, it has been very important. There comes a point where I decide to start writing in part to figure out whether I'm done with my research or not.
Oh, that's because interesting.
There are holes sometimes that pop up when you start to actually write it, and you might think you've got everything. I mean, in this case, so this book, people will see, but the book mixes animal research and human research, because there's been a lot of both in this subject, and the animal research is the stuff that where actually the big strides in understanding biology and evolution have taken place in terms of social behavior. But I will say that I went to a whole bunch of kind of like conferences about monkeys and apes, and finally I was at one and I said, you know, Lydia, you've done enough, you know enough about monkeys, you have permission to stop on this front. And so that was just one piece of it, but I knew I was going like sort of too far down one, you know. But then writing helps me to discover, I mean, by that point you may not have heaps of time to really go far on some new tangent. But for instance, the social media chapter, there was new work happening right up until the last second. And so mm-hmm. I was changing that chapter quite a bit between having turned in my book and turning back in the first pass proofs. And because there was new science and I had been to new conferences and been talking to new people. And
I actually just hit pause on editing a chapter because of that textbook I mentioned, and then three or four new studies and one meta study that just came out. And in order to make sure that what I'm writing about today, and fingers crossed, you know, when the book comes out, is as up to date as possible. But it's really hard to say, well, now I'm done. For me, there tends to be this moment. I continue to do like online classes and webinars and things like that. And there tends to be this moment where I'm listening to the webinar and I'm like, I know all this.
Yes.
And that's when I know, okay, if I know this, it's probably time for me to put a lid on researching this topic.
That, I think that is exactly right. And I have definitely had that experience too. But I will also say that there are some pieces of it where, especially with science, where if you're feeling that your grasp is maybe not as strong as you'd like it to be of something, but sometimes you do just have to wade in. I mean, I do anyway, and see where it goes and see how. And I'm sure you have the same. I mean, my problem is in my writing often is just that I have a tendency to get into the weeds and then I have to cut all that out, but I got to write it. I've got to write it. I've got to, you know, and try to understand. Would this actually, I would just like, this is not relevant to the organization and research, but I do feel that an important thing about writing about science and even if you don't really write about science, if you adopt a little bit of a science writer's approach, you're really forced to think about whether your audience is with you and whether you've given them enough hand-holding and enough signposting so that they can follow along with the story and what's important and why and what's not. And so then when I go back over the, you know, what I've written, I'm usually trying to figure out, you know, tracking along with someone who doesn't know it as well as I do and see, is this, do they really need to know this? You know,
that's what I was going to say. That's the question I constantly have, which is when I was going through and my chapters were, you know, I realized, oh my gosh, I have a chapter that's like 20,000 words.
Right.
Does my reader really need to know how many casks of beer there were on that first ship that sailed from it?
Exactly. You know, that's so funny you say that because I have a ship. I don't know whether you read it that early on with the monkeys traveling from India to Puerto Rico. And I was into how many bananas, how many pounds of bananas they ate. And I was like, maybe. And my editor did. She sort of said,
yes. That's our new standard for too much research, is if you know the details of what was in the hold of the first ship that your topic involved.
Right.
That's
right.
It. We've got a black line there, people. This is great.
But I do. The problem with me is I love those details, and love that sort of. And
I
in some
it was
places,
fascinating.
In some places, it paints an incredible picture. Like your ability to say, "Here's how many bananas," might be useful, but for the most part, it's really important to say, does my reader need to know this thing in order to understand the broad concept? And that's usually my last pass edit when I'm cutting is, oh, wait a second. These next four paragraphs are so irrelevant to anything. So a little whack it out of here. Yeah.
Right. And I will, just for the record, I want to state that part of why I had that detail was because, and part of my point was that in the story was that these monkeys were a source of fascination for everybody at the time, and so much so that they were featured in the New York Times at the time that they were traveling and then in Life magazine. And so I was sort of making the point that the New York Times was so interested that they counted the amount of pounds of bananas, but you're still right. They still didn't need to know that.
Yeah, no, that's the line I often say is from On Writing, where Tabitha King criticizes Stephen King for writing too much about these intervening years in this one character's life. And he's like, yeah, but it's really important. And she said, yeah, but you don't have to bore me with it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You maybe need to know it, but your reader might not need to know it. So
exactly. Well, but you'll always know how many bananas those monkeys needed. So that's important for you to know for the rest of your life.
You know, exactly.
KJ, did you want to jump in? I've been hogging the mic.
No, it's been great.
Good.
I'm riding along and taking notes.
Excellent. The things, I mean, obviously for me, this book came along at a really great time for me because I love talking about, you know, adolescence and relationships and friendships. But what I was most interested in with your book right now is thinking about virtual friendships and in-person friendships. And you talk a little bit about how much time you need to spend in what you call sort of togetherness makes for a friend. And you said there's a quote in the book about the fact that it takes 50 hours of togetherness to make a friend and 200 hours to make a best friend. So what if we spend 50 hours, you know, chatting about stuff, maybe tweeting at each other, that kind of, are we allowed to still be friends, or do we have to have 50 hours of in-person time?
We can still be friends. The thing about social media...
Oh, good.
Yes. Because I like you. I like you both. But I will say that what's interesting about social media is that most people, their online life and their offline life sort of mirror each other. And most of us know very well. And people talk all the time about how the word friend is devalued currency by Facebook and things like that. But the truth is, most people know who their real friends are, who their closest mm-hmm. friends are. And we sort of all have concentric circles of people really close and then a little further out and a little further out. And I would argue that if you only have a relationship online, it's more likely to be in the outer reaches of your social circles, which is fine. That's an important place to be. Those relationships have all kinds of benefits. But most of us, our closest friends, we use social media as kind of an extra channel to deepen the relationship, but not exclusively. Right.
So I like thinking about it that way.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned that quality is important over quantity anyway. So the quality of those relationships, and you also give me a license to sort of let go of some of those fraught relationships that may not be in my best interest, because you talk about the fact that ambivalent or those sort of frenemies relationships are not necessarily good for our health in the same way that all positive relationships are.
They are not even not necessarily, they turn out to be actually bad for your health, which surprised the researchers. They thought maybe the good outweighs the bad, and you know, but no, biologically speaking, when they look at your blood pressure and the aging in your cells and your immune system, they see that relationships. So an ambivalent, just to define our terms, since we are talking about science writing, so an ambivalent relationship is one that makes you feel both good and bad, like a frenemy, like you said. And also it's important to say that the people who've done this research had a pretty broad way of measuring that. If you weren't 100% terrific all the time about this relationship, or it wasn't 100% positive, then it was ambivalent. And the truth is that's like half our relationships, though, have some negative mm-hmm. to them.
I was going
to
say that's pretty broad.
It is pretty broad. And they're still sort of perfecting, you know, this research is relatively new, but it's kind of pointing to an interesting and important idea, though, which is that, yes, we don't actually have to maintain every relationship. Like some of your older friends where you have shared history, but who now are actually quite draining, maybe you don't have to stay friends with those people. I'm giving you permission there too. But for the relationships that you, where you can't or don't want to end the relationship or sort of really minimize the relationship, then you should be working on the quality of it, because that is really the critical thing. The research is so clear that the quality of relationships matters most and matters more than whether it's a relative or not a relative. So that's another thing I think I would just like to point out about friendship, is that the science kind of blurs the lines that we've always clung to about the importance of family over friends and things like that. Friends tended to be dropped down to the bottom, but we actually use the word friend. Like if you say your spouse is your best friend, you are trying to convey something about the quality of your relationship, right? And mm-hmm. not everybody would say that about their spouse. Some do, some don't. And in fact, there's a hilarious study that found that in Jacksonville, Florida, something like 60% of the people said that their spouse was their best friend. And in Mexico City, it was like 0%, which I don't think tells us about how
more to do with how we define it. Exactly.
But you know, the point is, let's at least think about this. And
I like that they both start with F. I just put it under one. It's one category for me. Extra, you know, important time with friends or family. That's one thing. That's right. The F section.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So I wanted to come back to this question of, here you were as a writer with this idea that encompassed a really deep scientific piece, but also what I think we could call a service piece. You know, the idea of friendship and how it helps us, and exactly what we're getting into talking about right now. How did you structure the pitch for this book to include both of those things?
So I think of myself more as a literary science writer, is for lack of a better phrase, and that is a thing compared to really self-helpy science. So I wouldn't exactly say that this book, and I didn't pitch it as self-help or as, you know, and yet it, if you read this book, you will absolutely come away knowing that you should invest in your friendships and here's a bunch of ways to do it.
Well, I wondered if there was pressure to push it in that other direction.
So some, and this is a constant tightrope that I feel I walk as a science writer, is because yes, most of what's out there and that, you know, has a really big audience is the stuff that is so super accessible that it doesn't include a lot of the details that I, you know, find really interesting and important. And so
no bananas.
And so
no, but
a lot of the good stuff goes. I will say this. So in the end, to specifically answer your question, what I did was pitch this book as the kind of friendship book that has not yet been written, because it would have serious science in it. Mm-hmm. And that is what is new and interesting and important to know. And it sort of informs everything that's in those self-help articles. And so I was positioning myself in my pitch. And it helped that my previous two books were similar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I have a certain style of writing. And if you're, like I am, a contributing editor at Scientific American, people do expect you to be on the serious side of science, but still completely accessible. I mean, that is the thing, is no matter who you are, you have to write it as if anybody will understand it. I try hard, you know, but
even
yeah.
Your scientific audience is not necessarily experts in everything.
No. And in fact, one of the things that's really interesting is this book covers so much ground and so much territory that some of the experts in it, when they read it, then said, oh, but I love how you wrote about my piece, but I didn't know anything about this other thing, you know? And I found that I was bringing them together somewhat because I was talking to everyone across the board, you know, not in the little silos that people
right.
tend to work in. But I just want to say that the Sloan, for instance, though, there's a real tension. So, you know, my agent would say, you really need to come up with a way to pitch this that, you know, will appeal to everybody. But then, for instance, the Sloan Foundation, their question was, how sciencey will this be? Because we are only really interested in it if it is a truly science, you know, if it is, in fact, a science book.
Mm-hmm.
And but you can write a science book that has all kinds of story in it. I mean, science is story, you know, it's figuring out how we know things, and there's a lot of plot twists and intriguing problems, and, you know, it's the evolution of thought in some ways. I ended up deciding that I have to be me. I have to, you know, you do you, right? Don't you guys say that?
Yeah.
And that I, you know, I was pitching it as not, you know, not self-help, but, and yet, in the overview of the proposal, it really did say that this book will put friendship at the center of our lives. It will show us these important things we need to know. And one of the things I say a lot is that we think we know all about friendship because it's familiar. And but in fact, there's a huge amount we don't know. And also, we do not, in fact, prioritize it always quite to the extent that we think we do. And so that stuff, those kind of larger statements that are in the proposal and that I talk about when I do publicity are very much, you know, about sort of trying to pull people in and tell them why this is relevant to their mm-hmm. lives.
I think one of the reasons that I loved, I loved this book, but I really loved I Can Hear You Whisper because there was this really personal element, and that I love reading science books that are also part memoir, and that's also a really difficult line to walk. In fact, the book I'm editing now turned out to be so much more memoir than I ever expected it to be. In fact, I was really scared of it becoming a memoir, and yet all of a sudden, now I'm at the other end after a couple of years, and it is very much a memoir, so much so that we've, you know, amped up that side of it. But I think that's what makes the science personal. And I think that's what helps people say, oh, so that's why it matters. That's why these numbers matter. That's why these statistics matter, is because they're about personal stories. And I think you do a beautiful job of walking that line, which can be really hard to see sometimes.
It can, and thank you. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome.
I will just point out as a sort of craft example that the introduction to this book starts on this island in Puerto Rico where people are studying monkeys. And that's a pretty surprising place to start a book on friendship, you might think. And yet it is, I think it's interesting because it's surprising, but it's all, and it makes for a really great scene. And it is also sort of signals that this is a new way of thinking about friendship. So I wrote all that with some other stuff about, you know, the big picture stuff in that intro. But I ended that chapter with me coming back from Puerto Rico and finding my then 17-year-old son on the couch with his best friend where they were playing video games, and it felt like they had never left from when I went to Puerto Rico to when I came back. It was as if they had never left. And I, you know, so there's a scene there in which I am doing the typical parent thing of, don't you guys have anything better to do? And, you know, don't you ever get up off this couch and all that stuff. And then I suddenly realized, and this did really happen, I said, oh, wait, hang on a minute, Lydia. They look a lot like those monkeys you were just watching in that they are hanging out together and they are laughing and they are joking and they're literally sitting in proximity on the couch. And maybe you are only seeing the video game as a parent and you are not seeing the visceral connection that is going on between these kids. And so I put that scene at the end of that first chapter or the introduction specifically to get at exactly what you're asking about, that to show why and how this stuff is useful in thinking about our own lives and our own relationships and friendships.
And that's great storytelling. I love that. I am smiling from ear to ear. To me, that's when you have those moments when you're writing. I talk about this all the time, about that buzz, that when you really feel like, oh my gosh, it's happening. The writing is coming together. And in those moments where you say, that's the story, that's
right.
When my heart just flutters. I get so excited.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I tried to do that all through this book. I wasn't sure how. I didn't really want to just sort of throw in a whole lot of random people that you only meet briefly. So I decided that the memoir-y part, I do have sort of myself and my family and my good friends kind of sprinkled through the book, because that seemed like the most organic way to get at what's true about relationships. And I fully recognize that, you know, we are a little subsection, we are not, that doesn't make it a diverse but that's not the point. The point is just to sort of provide those kinds of moments of recognition and resonance for readers.
That's what it's all about. Speaking of which, because we are getting to the end of our time, and I hate making these jarring transitions, because I could talk about this book for ages because I love it so much and I love science writing so much, but we are running out of time. And so I would love to talk about what you have been reading and what KJ and I have been reading. Do you have anything you'd like to shout out bookwise?
I would love to. So on the sciencey front, I have been reading Susanna Cahalan's new book, The Great Pretender. Have you
I'm
read
really
it?
Excited because I loved Brain on Fire.
Yes. And Susanna, this is such an interesting book because it really is about the history of psychiatry and mental health, but it's this totally great story about a study that was done years ago that kind of where they sent sane people into insane asylums essentially and sort of tried to reveal, you know, it was like the investigative journalism of science about, you know, what does it take to get out of an insane asylum.
But and that's why I haven't started reading it yet, because frankly, I know about this experiment. In fact,
right.
We were looking at the book and my husband pointed to it and he said, oh, I know that experiment. And he was explaining it to me. And I said, that is terrifying to me. And that's the reason I haven't, like, being a sane person in an insane asylum and then having to prove that you're not insane, yet that makes you look insane. That whole concept freaks me out.
Right. And then there's a real plot twist, though, in this whole book that I won't, but it turns out that study is not everything that we thought it was. And so there's an extra. So anyway, there's that book. And I also just want to say, in addition to science and all the other things, I'm a rabid fan of mysteries and thrillers. And so I read like one a week. And this week it was...
Gimme, yeah, what you got?
It was called The Ruin by Dervla McTernan. Have you heard of her? She's Irish,
no,
living in Australia. And that's why I was so thrilled, because it's really great. Those Irish, the man, they know how to do crime and thrillers. And and the Ruin came out in 2018. It was her first one. There's already another one, and it's really good stuff. So
I'm going to be listening to that. Yes. One I can already tell. Speaking of which, actually, I had never let myself get sunk into, and I mentioned it one time before on the podcast, but I abandoned it. I'm finally going back to the very first Joe Gunther novel by Archer Mayer about, and it started his whole path about writing mysteries in Vermont. This one is called Open Season, and there's a little introduction in the audiobook explaining that he had written this. He was trying to write this whole book with like intrigue and all these spies and people all over the place. And it was set in some far-flung locale. And then he realized that it really needed a sense of place. And Vermont became that place. And the story became much simpler. And it became a much more intimate story. And it became about Vermont and the people of Vermont and the things that happen there. And so I'm now in the book Open Season. I'm like halfway through and I'm really, really enjoying it and loving sort of getting that sense of place in Vermont. It's really cool. KJ, what do you have?
I just finished Eleanor Oliphant is Fine. Or
really?
Maybe it's Eleanor Oliphant is Perfectly Fine. I've actually sort of just forgotten. It doesn't really make any difference. And it took me 2 tries at this one. I think I have thoughts. I have many thoughts. I have so many thoughts. It's practically a podcast episode. But so this book, if you read the back of it, it's like,
she's completely fine, by the way.
Yeah. Eleanor Oliphant is, you know,
she's
a little weird
fine.
and she's a little like a little dry, and she doesn't know how to interact with other people. And this is catnip to me. I really like that stuff, that sort of thing. And you know, she's going to learn how to like, so it feels like that. And then you read the comments at the bottom and it's like, you know, move over a man called Ove. We've got a new curmudgeon and Reese Witherspoon loves it. And it's going to be a movie. So
yeah,
you're like, okay, it's going to be like one of those sort of happy autism stories. Okay, whatever. But then
happy autism stories.
About midway through the first chapter, you're like, wait a minute, this person was a victim of really serious child abuse. Like, this is not, I mean, it's a positive and hopeful story, but I really felt like curmudgeon was probably not the word we were looking for. So I felt sort of betrayed by the marketing. And the first time, yeah, I was just like, yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not ready for, mm-hmm, you know, dealing with this person's emotional journey away from their history of child abuse, which is actually really good. And then I picked it back up again a couple of months later when I did feel more mentally prepared for that, I guess. And it's not, I mean, it's not like it's not, I don't know if it's triggering or not, because this is not my history, but it isn't, it's a fun read in a very weird sort of way.
Huh.
But the marketing is more than a little bizarre.
Yeah, KJ does not like to be duped by the marketing of a book. And
I
she
don't.
Definitely doesn't like to be tricked into reading something sad.
This wasn't, yes, sad, though.
I think not wanting to be duped is absolutely fair. I'm with you on that.
Everybody, I've actually handed this to multiple people who hadn't read it and said, read the back, and now I'm going to tell you what it's really about. I'm not crazy, am I? And they're like, no.
Interesting.
Not what it sounded like.
So, Lydia, your release is coming up, and this podcast is going to go up right around your book release. What kind of,
yes,
festivities do you have planned for your book release?
Oh, I will be my local bookstore. So this is my chance. Community Bookstore in Park Slope, Brooklyn. Oh, they are so wonderful. And they have been with me from day one with my first book. And I will be there with the writer Stephen Johnson doing a Brooklyn launch. And then I will be doing a Manhattan launch with the writer Randy Hutter Epstein, who is also a friend. They're all friends. I called on all my friends to do my events. And community is great. I just have to say, when my last book came out, they actually put a chalkboard out on the sidewalk that said, Lydia Denworth's new book is here. And I was never felt so special. I'm famous in a 10 block square radius. I mean, literally 10 block square. That's it. But in that 10 blocks, I was worthy of a chalkboard.
You were a rock star.
I was a rock star. And that made me feel special and like a real writer. And so I will love them forever.
There's nothing better than a bookstore that has your back and is really pulling for you. And I say that as a person my local bookstore put my book up on a stand by itself with many, many copies for almost a year after its release. And that bookstore does not exist anymore. And I am so sad. So sad.
Yeah.
KJ, did you have something?
I was going to say before we close out, I'm going to confess to where I was while you were... while you were describing your latest read, which was I was looking for a book that I think Lydia will love, because the minute she said, "Those Irish, they really know how to do the dark," I went, "Oh, Sarah Stuart Taylor's new book, The Mountains Wild, for which she learned to speak Irish and went to Ireland and did all kinds of things." So I have already emailed you the link.
Beautiful.
Sounds like it'll be right up your
alley.
Thank
you.
Thank you. I'll pop it in the show notes too.
Excellent. Her mysteries are wonderful. She has a whole series that's already been out, and she talk about doing a lot of research in order to write her mysteries. She goes deep. She goes seriously deep.
Well, and there's a lot of science in mysteries and thrillers too. So it's everywhere. It's everywhere.
Yeah, it's everywhere. All right. Well, this has been just delightful. Can you tell our listeners where they can find you, Lydia?
The easiest place is my website, which is LydiaDenworth.com, but I'm on Twitter and I'm the same everywhere, pretty much. Twitter, I'm Lydia Denworth, and actually, I guess on Facebook. So I do, and I know you've talked about this, I have an author page and a personal page, and I don't really follow people on my personal page. So the author page is Science Writer Lydia.
Good. Yeah, that's excellent. All right, everyone, until next week, keep your butts in the chair and your head in the game. This episode of Hashtag MWriting with Jess and KJ was produced by Andrew Perella. Our music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and performed by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their services because everyone, even creatives, should be paid for their work. Pause. Stop. Stop.
Thank you.